we do that, one question that emerged last week was, Pastor Glenn, it sounds like we don't hold anybody accountable for anything. That love means no accountability. And there were several versions of that. And I certainly don't want to leave that impression. So let's talk just a little bit about that, and then we'll move into 1 Corinthians 7. When Paul's talking here about excommunicating people, in his culture that may have worked. In our culture, that rarely works. It usually causes more problems. But that doesn't mean, in light of all the things that I said last week, that there's no accountability. So, as it relates to human sexuality and gay marriage, if somebody came to Pastor Greg, Pastor Gary, Pastor PJ, or I, two men or two women, and said, would you marry us? We would say no. That's not a change. That's been something that's been part of Good Shepherd since its inception. It's been the prevailing attitude of the church for 2,000 years. When our denomination 5 or 6 years ago, at a close vote of all the churches, said, we are now opening the doors. Each individual church can respond to this issue in a way that's authentic to that church. Some churches have adopted another policy. We just simply said we're not changing for a lot of reasons. So that's one level of accountability. There are other levels of accountability that are not public. So people who come to me or Greg or Gary or PJ, or sometimes it emerges up into the church council, and are dealing with sexual issues, they are prevented from being in leadership. We just don't go public about that. We just don't say, and here's the list of people that we've said, you can't be in leadership this week. Because shame tends not to be a good motivator in our culture, so we do that. And there are people who come to us and say, would you do our marriage, our wedding? And it may have sounded like anybody has carte blanche to that, and that's not necessarily the case. We quite often will say to people, you know, we think you need to seek out some counseling to help clear up some things in your own life before you jump into this thing called marriage. But it's a tough thing to do because I don't have a radar screen into everyone's soul. I can't know everything that's going on in a person's life. There have been two times in my pastoral life, and I've done about 60 or 70 weddings, where I've said no. That's gone over really well. One of them was a young woman who came to me and said, would you do the wedding? And she was pregnant already. And I could tell that when the young man came on the third appointment, he didn't make the first two, he was not really moving into this with all the commitment that I thought would probably do well in this marriage. And of course, how do I know? I can't necessarily read that. But in this case, it was clearly obvious. He made it painfully obvious. And I said to the girl, I said, why are you getting married to him? And well, he's the father, and his father's telling him it's the right thing to do. He's got to do it. I said, do you love him? Do you really want to be married to him? She said, I don't know. I said, I can't do the marriage. They left the church. The family left the church. The family of the family of the family left the church. Friends of the family left the church. And this was in a brand new church that had just started a year and a half before. That was really tough, trust me. They ended up getting married, and they ended up getting divorced about 2 months later. Another one that I said no to, I said, I won't do your marriage because you're living together, and I know you two very well, and you've been living together for a year. Unless you will separate and get separate apartments and do that for 6 months and agree to be celibate in your relationship, I'm not doing the wedding. And they looked at me like I was from Mars. But it was my little brother. So he said, well, we really want you to do the wedding. I said, trust me on this. I think it's going to be good. You need to get your spiritual life in order. And today, and I'm not saying that I did this, but they got started on a path of Christian faithfulness. They're regular participant in community Christian church, very thriving ministries that they have together. They've been married almost 20 years. They've got a couple of kids. and they love Jesus and they're following him. So those are some of the ways that we hold people accountable. Well, it's messy though. And it's hard. And the underlying principle for me is one that's going to carry over into 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And that is, what brings the most glory to God? What will further the mission of the church as best as possible? So let me jump into 1 Corinthians. The second thing I wanted to throw out there today too is that we're heading into a discussion of marriage and sexuality and the relationships between husband and wife. And this is one of the hardest things for me to teach on. Why? Because I have failed miserably at everything I'm about to tell you you should do. And any pastor that stands in front of you and says he or she hasn't, that's one of the challenges of being a teacher, is that sometimes I have to teach about stuff that I haven't gotten right, that I'm struggling with. So thank you for your grace. Let's apply that to each other. Having said that, this is a really cool, amazing, powerful, sometimes confusing, but wonderful passage. Before I read it, I want to play you a song. And when I play this song, I want to know, what is your natural instinct on what you should do in response to this song? Let's see if I can get this right. Nope, wrong one. This one. What should you do? How many of you have been to a wedding when you heard this? Okay, you can sit down. What we just showed evidence of is what's called a cultural script. We all have a cultural script. We bring our expectations, our hopes, our dreams, our experiences to the study of marriage in 1 Corinthians 7. When you heard the music, most of you, your first tendency was to do what? To stand up. Why? Because that's what you do. Where's that written? I'm sure somewhere in some guide to marriage, I'm sure you can find that on the internet somewhere. When they play this song, you should stand up. That's because it's culturally laid into our life. Well, we have a whole bunch of those things, so those are the things that we have to figure out, what the difference is between our cultural script and what Paul says, what God says, what the Spirit says in the Word, and we all bring them. Some of them are good. There's nothing wrong with standing during that song. But there's a few others that maybe aren't as helpful, so let's turn to 1 Corinthians 7. I'm reading from the NIV. You may have the exact same wording. You might have slightly different wording because there are two or three editions of the NIV where they slightly clean up a few translation issues. You may have a different translation. We're going to talk about some of the translation issues, but here I go, 1 Corinthians 7. Now for the matters you wrote about, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But since sexual immorality is occurring, each man should have sexual relations with his own wife and each woman with her own husband. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. Too many pastors stop there. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. Do not deprive each other, except perhaps by mutual consent and for a time, so that you may devote yourselves to prayer. Then come together again so that Satan will not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not a command. I wish that all of you were as I am. Paul's single. That's what he's referring to there. But each of you has your own gift from God. One has this gift and another has that. Now to the unmarried and the widows, I say, it is good for them to stay unmarried as I do. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. To the married I give this command, not I, but the Lord. A wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she must remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and a husband must not divorce his wife. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. If any brother has a wife who is not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he must not divorce her. And if a woman has a husband who is not a believer and he's willing to live with her, she must not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified through her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but as it is, they are holy. But if the unbeliever leaves, let it be so. The brother or sister is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. How do you know, wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you will save your wife? Nevertheless, each person should live as a believer in whatever situation the Lord has assigned to them, just as God has called them. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. Was a man already circumcised when he was called? He should not become uncircumcised. That'd be kind of hard to do anyway. Thanks, Paul, though, for that help. Was a man uncircumcised when he was called? He should not be circumcised. Now, that is helpful. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Do you feel the tension there? Because circumcision is a command. So apparently there are some commands that Paul's leaving behind, but we'll get to that. Each person should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. Although if you can gain your freedom, do so. For the one who was a slave when called to faith in the Lord is the Lord's freed person. Similarly, the one who was free when called is Christ's slave. You were bought at a price. Do not become slaves of human beings. Brothers and sisters, each person as responsible to God should remain in the situation they were in when God called them. Now about virgins, I have no command from the Lord, but I give a judgment as one who by the Lord's mercy is trustworthy. Because of the present crisis, I think that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? He's talking about people who are engaged. Do not look for a wife, but if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. But those who marry will face many troubles in this life. Don't laugh at that. Come on. And I want to spare you this. Yikes! Thanks a lot, Paul. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not, those who mourn as if they did not, those who are happy as if they were not, those who buy something as if it was not theirs to keep, those who use things of the world as if not engrossed in them. For this world in its present form is passing away, and I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord. But a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife, and his interests are divided. An unmarried woman or virgin is concerned about the Lord's affairs. Her aim is to be devoted to the Lord in both body and spirit. But a married woman is concerned about the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. I'm saying this for your own good, not to restrict you, but that you may live in a right way in undivided devotion to the Lord. If anyone is worried that he might not be acting honorably toward the virgin he is engaged to, and if his passions are too strong and he feels he ought to marry, he should do as he wants. He's not sinning. They should get married. But the man who has settled the matter in his own mind, who is under no compulsion but has control over his own will, and who's made up his mind not to marry the virgin, this man also does the right thing. So then, he who marries the virgin does right, but he who does not marry her does better. A woman is bound to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she is free to marry anyone she wishes, but he must belong to the Lord. In my judgment, she is happier if she stays as she is. And I think that I, too, have the Spirit of God. Any questions? This is probably the longest and most comprehensive teaching on issues related to marriage and marriage and covenant. The first thing that I want to introduce to you, though, is a problem that starts in chapter 7, verse 1. Did anyone have a different translation than this? Now for the matters you wrote about. It is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. It really depends on whether or not that sentence is in quotes or not. Let me show you what I mean. So here's 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1 to 2a. The NIV, now for the matters you wrote about, quote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, end quote. But since sexual immorality is occurring, Paul is saying, here's what you wrote to me in a letter. Here's the statement you made. You said to me, it's good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Or some translations say, it's good for a man not to be married to a woman. Paul's saying, that's what you said to me. That turns the whole letter around. If you take the quotes out, it looks like Paul is saying, look, let's just start with this. It's good for a man not to have sexual relations or be married. That's not what he's saying at all. Not at all. So look at the rest of the translations. The English Standard Version. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote. Again, quote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations. The New North American Standard Bible. Now concerning the things about which you wrote. Ah, no quotes. It is good for a man not to touch a woman. There's a bunch of real conservative folks on that translation committee because they're looking at the same Greek words as the other people in the first two. The NRSV, now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is well for a man not to touch a woman, quotes around that. The KJV, now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. And the Lexham English Bible, now concerning the things about which you wrote, and again, it's in a quote. It matters if that clause is in a quote or not. And many people, having read the Bible without those quotes, think that Paul is saying, look, sex is bad, marriage is bad. Let's just start there. And he couldn't be saying anything further from that. Absolutely not what Paul is saying. But if he's responding to their questions, let's remember the context. There's a group of people that have come to him and given him a verbal report of what's happening in Corinth. There's another group of people that had given him a verbal report. He already wrote one letter. This is his second letter responding. So he's responding to a question that they said, Paul, we think it's good for a man not to touch or have sexual relations or be married to a woman, quote, end quote. What do you think? And Paul's going to tell them what he thinks, and he thinks they're crazy. And he's going to say so. Do you see how translation issues, that's just one verse. You get chapter 7, verse 1 wrong, and everything after that gets really strange and confusing. You get that right, and now everything opens up, because now Paul is responding to specific instances. He's not giving a full, complete treatise on marriage, although this is his most complete treatment of it. He's responding to questions that they're asking, to problems that they're having. So let's talk a little bit about that. Here are the questions that are coming from Corinth, either in a letter form or in verbal form from the reports he's getting back. What is the proper role of sex within marriage? Should we get married if we're single, if we're widowed, or if we're divorced? When and for what reasons is abstinence appropriate? What about celibacy? What is my responsibility if I'm engaged? How should I think about singleness? What about children? Will changing my status from married to unmarried, from unmarried to married, will changing my status improve my spiritual life? And what if my spouse is an unbeliever? Those are the questions rippling through just this one chapter. Some of those questions we may not have thought of, but I would say most of those questions, sooner or later, all of us have encountered those, right? How many of you have an opinion on whether or not it's better to be married or stay single? Don't raise your hands. I have heard many times, not just here, but in throughout my life, people talking and saying, you know, he's still not married. What's wrong with him? She's still single. What's the deal? I could never do that. Well, you're right. And that's precisely what Paul means when he says, whatever your gift is, whatever your calling is, whatever your predisposition is, and therein lies one of the challenges is that there's 200 women here, there's 200 personalities. He's giving underlying principles based on giving you guidance depending upon your personality in terms of your sexual preferences. Can I say that? Yep. So let's talk about the backstory. You have to understand the status of men, women, children, and marriage and singleness in Roman culture and in Jewish culture, because Paul's bringing both. Some of those things are different. So his answers to them might be different than his answers would be if he were here. Some of his answers are, I think, going to be the same if he were here, because the situation hasn't changed in some instances. Let me give you some examples. The Jewish view on marriage is that it is primarily a union between a husband and one wife for life. It's a covenant relationship. That is the prevailing Jewish attitude. People say, why didn't Jesus talk about homosexuality? Because within his culture, in Israel, he's preaching to 99% Jews. He doesn't have to, because that's the common understanding. The common understanding at the time of a Jewish person goes all the way back to Genesis. God created man and woman, and they should be married, and they should stay married forever till death do us part. So that helps you understand Jesus' teaching on divorce, Jesus' teaching on sexuality, Jesus' teaching on lust. Paul just picks that up, and he's got that Jewish view. The Jewish view also included that marriage was primarily for procreation. That sex within marriage is for procreation. Although there's tension, you can find different Jewish teachers saying, no, it's a little bit more than that. Have you read Song of Solomon? Let me just read to you from the Bible's, can I say, erotic literature? Because that's what it is. And for 2,000 or 3,000 years, people have tried to spiritualize it and theologize it. Let me just read from Song of Solomon, chapter 1, verse 1. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the young women love you. Take me away with you. Let us hurry. Let the king bring me into his chambers. I'll stop there. If you've never read Song of Solomon, I highly recommend it. It's one of the most beautiful love stories, poems, and it's rich in sexual imagery, but it's pure sexual imagery. It's lovely sexual imagery. It's inspired sexual imagery. Apparently, God thinks sex is a really cool thing in a certain context, done a certain way, with the mutuality and respect and love. And you can read all about it in Song of Solomon. And there were many rabbis and Jewish theologians who said, let's stop this idea that sex is only to make children, and when you have enough of them, you stop. It has a whole bunch of other rich, deep meaning within the context of marriage. So please take this seriously, and we'll see how much Paul takes that seriously. So that's the Jewish view. The Jewish view of women is that women cannot institute a divorce. Men can, but women can't. I could say to you, I don't like the way you made the chicken soup last Friday, honey. Too bad. You and I are now divorced. That's all I needed to do. A woman in Jewish culture could not do the same thing. If I divorce my wife in Jewish culture, she has no rights. She has no economics, and I get the kids. That's the Jewish view. You move into the Greco-Roman view, and the Greco-Roman view is a little bit more expanded. A woman could institute divorce. She could implement divorce. She could say, honey, it's just not working. You're not treating me. However, for whatever reason, she could file for divorce. She'd still have to argue her case, but she could file for divorce. There was that mutuality within the law courts in Rome. However, the man tended to keep all the wealth and all the property, and the man got the kids. So you can go ahead and get divorced. But then you're left with no protection, without your kids, and without any resources to take care of yourself. And that's a precarious place to be in Greco-Roman culture. So if you keep those things in mind when Paul says, look, be careful if you're a wife and you've come to know Jesus, but your husband has not, don't just think you ought to automatically divorce him, because if you do, you're going to lose your kids. And therefore, you lose your proximity to them, and you don't want to do that because you want to lead them to the gospel. And maybe through your life, your husband will come to know the Jesus that you know. So don't run from that marriage. And that's the background against what Paul is saying. Another view that you have to understand is that for Romans, there was certainly the sense that in marriage you wanted to have sex so that you could procreate. But sex was a lot more expanded. The view of sex within Roman culture was much more expanded. And so men were given the right, and many of them were expected to go outside of the marriage. You could go to the temple. And the temple had prostitutes. And you could say, well, today's Tuesday. I think I'll have... That's how easy it was, and that was expected. In fact, if I said the word Sin City, what city in the United States am I talking about? Is there anyone that doesn't know that? Is there anyone that's been there and would deny that? I've been there once. I know, you go for the shows. I know. Oh. I was scared there. Because of the things that were going on in my soul. Because of the temptations that were like right there. So if you go to Vegas, please be careful. The reason I bring that up is because Corinthians knew that Corinth was the Vegas of the Roman world. In fact, if you wanted to talk about a person's moral stature, you'd say, you Corinthian. And everyone would know, oh, they are sexually promiscuous. That's the background. There's a temple with somewhere between 300 and 1,000 temple prostitutes. There's the prevailing attitude that men can do whatever they want. Women secretly were encouraged to do things that they would want. Just don't get caught because it'll go bad for you. That's the prevailing attitude. So Paul is saying, wait a second, look, any direction you move, there are landmines all around you. Landmines all around you. Stop, think, be careful. Here's my guidance to all of you in these various settings. Another part of this is that in Jewish view, children were sacred. In a Roman view, children were not necessarily sacred. Children were not recognized as persons until they were born. And the husband said, I now recognize you as a person. You are welcome in my family. That may happen a few days after birth. It may not happen for a while. So a child born in Roman society isn't a person with any legal standing until the husband says so. And I can show you letters from Roman culture where the husband or the governor or the mayor or the prefect would say, you know, our population is getting a little high. If you have a baby born to you that has special needs, they didn't use the word special needs. If you have a baby to you that's going to cause an economic burden, just leave it by the curb. Let the gods take care of it. If the gods deem that the baby should live, it will live. If the gods deem that the baby won't, it won't. Yeah, the ratio was pretty much that most of them died. That's the background. So Paul is also saying, wait a second, there are children involved. And he's bringing his Jewish ethic to a Roman culture and saying, I don't care what the culture says. You need to think about the gospel orientation of these kids. So abortion and what's called infanticide and those kinds of things were prevalent in Roman society, accepted. In Jewish society, they were not. So there are some overlap and some tension. And Paul's trying to bring this Jewish ethic and the best of a Roman ethic and what Jesus taught into a very practical situation at the church in Corinth, which is the Vegas of the ancient world. Welcome to Paul's pastoral life. It's not easy. So he gives some guidance. Is all that helpful to understand that background? Because now you can understand some of the tensions when he says, do this, but don't do that. This is from the Lord. This isn't from the Lord, but this is what I think you should do. So let's take some of the principles that Paul gives us. Sex is a sacred gift and to be mutually enjoyed. Let me read to you again what I read already. Each man should have sexual relations with his own wife. And that's in the Greek, it's the same. It's as if he said, and each woman should have sexual relations with her husband. It's both and. And then he goes into more detail. The husband should fulfill his marital duty to his wife, and likewise the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. All the men in Corinth would say, very good, thank you, Paul, I agree. Aha! But then the lector, the reader in the worship service, who's reading the letter from Paul, goes on and starts reading this. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but yields it to her husband. In the same way, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but yields it to his wife. That is absolutely countercultural in both Hebrew and Roman culture. Paul is saying at the foot of the cross, there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, rich or poor, Democrat or Republican, Sox fan, Cubs fan. There is equality at the foot of the cross. And that goes all the way into the deepest, most intimate human relationship, including marriage. So if, husband, you are lording it over your wife, remember what I said in chapter 1, the preaching of the cross is foolishness. Because of the cross, Mr. Husband, you better get your act together. This is a tough word to husbands. In that culture, you, husband, do not have authority over your body. You must offer it to your wife. And he's not just talking about in the final act. He's talking about in everything that builds up to sexual fulfillment, and everything after that, because it's a relationship of mutuality. That's the principle that Paul is bringing in. Sex is a sacred gift to be mutually enjoyed. That's powerful stuff. There's a few men I know that need to hear that. Would you agree? Don't rush into anything relating to marriage. If you're single, and that's your gift, in the long run, if your sexual energy can be contained within a celibate single life, then by all means, that frees you up to be a missionary. Go whenever God calls. Do whatever God calls. And you don't have to worry about all the things that come along with marriage. Not that those things are bad. But let's face it, if Paul had a wife and several children, he wouldn't have been able to walk 18,000 miles three times through the Roman Empire and say, honey, I'll catch up with you in 3 years. He's saying the highest principle here is the mission. Mutuality, respect, and servanthood. That's what love looks like in action. If you look at the inside of each of these statements from within the context that Paul's writing in, he's arguing for a mutuality, a respect, a love, and a servanthood. Serve one another in marriage. Serve each other as single people. Serve the mission of the church. Serve the Lord Jesus Christ. That's the highest principle. Two last principles, and then we'll get to the two questions he offers. Bodies matter. Paul is saying, look, the Lord is coming back, and here's the problem that they had. This is rippling through Corinthian culture. They're saying, look, Jesus could come back today at 2. So what's the point in getting married? I should be pure. I should just refrain from all sexuality. I should just stop everything. In fact, Jesus might come back so soon, I might as well just get divorced. I might as well end any other entrapment. And Paul's saying, yes, Jesus is coming, but no, don't change your status. If you're married, stay married. If you're single, stay single, if you can do that. But if you have a sexual longing, there's nothing wrong with that, and it's healthy. Its best expression is in a marriage of mutual covenant with this other person. So find one. That's great. But the highest principle is how can you best serve the Lord? So I know missionaries who are single, and they're free to move whenever God says move. I know missionaries that are married and have... When I was in New Guinea visiting my daughter, she lives right across the street from the New Tribes Mission Base, where about 100 families send their kids to school throughout the year. It's a really tough way to go. Married couples send their kids back to the home base where they go to school, so they're out in the bush translating the Bible, being missionaries, and they don't see their kids sometimes for 3, 4, 5 months. And some of them thrive, and their kids thrive. And some do not. And that's what Paul means when he says, what's your calling? What's your personality? If your personality is a gift from God such that you can maintain your focus on the Lord as a married person and it doesn't disturb your marriage and you can do that in a healthy way, then absolutely thrive. If, however, you can be single, then you can be called to Papua New Guinea or Africa or Ecuador or Guatemala or hundreds of other places, and you don't have anyone to turn around and be responsible for. That's Paul's primary purpose here. The Lord will return. But even if he returns this afternoon, let him find you, honoring him by doing your best as a missionary. That's his underlying premise in every single one of his letters and every statement that he makes. How else do you explain his, and if you're a slave, don't worry about it. You're free in the Lord. Well, of course, Paul didn't know about the state of slavery in 19th century United States of America prior to the Civil War. The state of slavery in Roman culture, there were three or four different statuses of a slave, and some slaves had a better life than non-slaves did. Some slaves at the bottom of the totem pole had a terrible life. I would argue that it's never right for one human being to own another. But Paul's moving in that direction, but he's saying, look, if you can, even as a slave, you can serve the Lord by being a missionary as a slave and maybe win your household. And that happened hundreds, thousands of times. Thousands of times. But he's also saying there's this little hint. You got to remember, two-thirds of Corinth is made up of slaves. So the city's about 100,000 people. Roughly 60,000 to 70,000 of them are slaves. So Paul's got to be very careful about what he says. If Paul says, and by the way, if you're a slave, run out right now with a protest sign and quit. That's probably not going to be the best missionary thing to do, and you need to understand the culture. Paul has no idea what's going to happen in 18th century, 19th century Europe and England and the United States. So he's not saying slavery is a good thing, although my southern friends back in 1840 and 1850 used this verse to say, look, God says that his economy is okay with slavery. We shouldn't try to change it. Well, that's not exactly what Paul's saying. He's speaking specifically to an issue here at Corinth. For us, we have to say, what's the principle that we can learn and apply it in our own life? So I think there are two questions that come from the text that help all of you, all of us, answer these questions. What status will enable you to serve God with maximum impact and personal purity? If your personal purity is going to come under question because it's really hard for you to live a single life, then don't. Get married. If in your marriage you're acting out sexually based on Roman ideas of what healthy sexuality is, stop, because your personal purity is being called into question, and ultimately that will not honor God. Second question, what way of life will equip you to be a joyful missionary to your culture? Those of you that are married, you should view, according to Paul, I think, your marriage as a missionary partnership. And I'm going to explain why in a second. Our ideas of marriage come with a lot of cultural stuff. But Paul has some ideas that I think are really powerful. And if we take those into our marriages and into our singleness and into our widowhood and into any of these statuses that Paul mentions and take pause and ask those questions, we will be guided. People say to me all the time, Pastor Glenn, what does God want me to do? Well, those are the questions that I think Paul raises, and those are the principles that he gives us. All this will be on the website so you can get it. We have to remember, go all the way back to chapter 1, Paul says the preaching of the cross has to change everything. It has to change your attitude, Mr. Husband, if you think that you can lord it over your wife. You need to look at the cross and see what Jesus did, because anyone that's following that Lord cannot lord it over his wife. Wife, you need to look at that cross and say, what did Jesus do for me? How can I bring that principle of servanthood and forgiveness and love and charity into my marriage? Same thing for single folks, widows, all of those things apply. Here's what I said last week and the week before that we get in the cross. In the cross, we receive healing power from Jesus. Jesus pays our ransom. He reconciles us with God. He brings us together. He makes us righteous before God. He grants us the benefits of Eden. He absorbs my penalty, adopts us into a new family. He empties the power of evil, empties the power of temptation. He makes us new creatures. He gives us victory over death, and he grants us citizenship. There's no better context in which to practice that than the mutuality of the intimacy of marriage or the intimacy of a single life devoted to the Lord. To experience the power of the cross in those ways, that in the cross you can crucify, you can bring under control those things that, left loose in Roman culture, will eat you alive. They will destroy you. But the cross is foolishness. It was foolish then. It's foolish now. When I said to my young brother, I'm not going to do your wedding until you separate for a time, he looked at me like I was crazy. And so did a lot of other people. I looked in the mirror and said, are you crazy? But something in my soul, something in prayer, something that the Spirit led me to say, I was trembling when I said to him, I can't do the wedding unless you two separate. And today, just a couple months ago, he said to my wife and I, thank you so much for that. Because you led us to Christ. And Christ has redeemed us, and our life is so much different than anything it would have been without Christ. I didn't do that. I just spoke into his life at a moment when he was open. But it sure looks like foolishness. It looks like foolishness when I go visit a person, a woman in a senior living facility, and she's 77 years old, and they moved into the senior living facility because her husband had Alzheimer's, but she's full of spunk and ready to go. And she says, I don't know what to do because now I have a witness in this place. And there are several people that I've been able to talk to about Jesus who are this close from following him. But I want to get out of this place, and I want to go find a husband because I miss the intimacy. And I said to her, let's pray. What does the cross tell you to do? Not what do I tell you to do. Which way can you be a better missionary for Jesus with purity in your life? And she stayed in that situation for 6 months, and then she left and now is remarried, and they live a great married life and are serving Jesus. But that's what Paul is asking us to do. There's no three easy steps. There's no one PowerPoint slide that says, aha, here it is. There's instead these deep questions. How can I serve the Lord with purity? How can I joyfully be a missionary giving glory to God? And every one of you and every one of us, and me included, have to answer that question. This is what it looks like when I do a wedding. Tyler and Rachel, you are a wonderful, intelligent, dynamic couple. And I'm so honored to be here with you too. Part of my calling in life is to raise up leaders wherever I see them, to help people live out God's calling on their lives, to serve anyone that's trying to make an impact on this world. And I see greatness in you. Now together, gifts, talents, calling, purpose, this is not an accident. Celebrations and family and friends matter. Radical, sacrificial love will prevail. Serve God and his calling on your life. And I cannot wait to see what the next decades will bring. Tyler and Rachel, today you are presenting yourselves before God, family, and friends to consecrate your marriage voluntarily and honorably for the glory of God and for your own joy. You are making a double dedication to each other in a lasting and indivisible union that shall endure for the remaining years of your lives, and to God, that he may make you intimate allies for the common mission to which he calls you both. This will require appreciation of each other's spiritual gifts, growth in spiritual virtues, forgiveness of each other's faults, and unfailing devotion to each other. There must be on your part a united and unhesitant acceptance by faith of the challenges that God sets before you. I charge you, therefore, to consider that your promises to each other are made in the presence of a God who remembers and holds you responsible for the commitments you make today. I caution you to keep in mind that each of you is the object of Christ's love and should be valued accordingly. I encourage you to share willingly and sympathetically your joys and sorrows, your successes and your struggles. And finally, I challenge each of you individually and both of you as a couple. Exalt the Lord Jesus Christ as the head of your house, the ruler of your destinies, and the object of your deepest love and devotion. There's nothing quite like two people committed to Christ entering into that most dangerous, most wonderful union. There's nothing like a single person who decides with great prayer and consternation and listening and discernment, I'm going to stay single and devote myself to Christ. Jesus, please give me the needs of my body. Help me to be faithful to you in purity. There's nothing quite like that. There's nothing quite like somebody who's been ravaged by divorce, by any one of these other situations that Paul has laid out, and then finds themselves being healed in Jesus Christ and being able to ask new life questions. Should I get remarried or should I stay single? There's nothing like a redeemed person in Christ entering into any of these situations. There's also nothing like a person who's just selfish and saying, I don't care what Jesus says. I want what I want when I want it, and whatever's good for me, that's what I'm going to do. Paul's talking about a clear differentiation here in all of these situations. He's drawing from some ancient stuff. Let me read to you from Genesis. Then God said, it's not a good thing that the man is alone. I'll make for him a helper as his counterpart. And out of the ground, God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky, and he brought each to the man to see what he would call it. And whatever the man called that living creature was its name. And the man gave names to every domesticated animal and to the birds of heaven and to all the wild animals. But for the man, there was not found a helper as his counterpart, equal. And God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man. While he slept, he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh where it had been. And Yahweh God fashioned the rib which he had taken from the man into a woman and brought her to the man. And the man said, she is now bone from my bones, flesh from my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken from man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and cling to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. And the man and his wife, both of them, were naked, and they were not ashamed. That's a powerful passage, and Paul is picking up on a mutuality. There's a mutuality of respect. There's a mutuality of sexual give and take. What does Paul say? He says, the only time I want you to come apart is to dedicate yourselves to prayer. Then come back together. He's not giving once and for all, this is how many times a week. Can I just say that? Because all of us have different marriages with a different rhythm, a different cadence, different personalities, different wants, different needs, and that's okay. It's more than okay. God has created that you that way and me that way. But if I enter into the sexual part of my relationship with my wife and I only want what I want, then I am wrong. And if she only wants what she wants, then she is wrong. If there's no mutuality, no respect, no coming together, Paul links sexuality and spirituality. Wow. When my youngest daughter, Jody, was about 6 years old, she came to me and she said, Daddy, I want to know about sex. And being the wise father that I am, I said, go ask your mother. She said, Daddy, I want to know about sex. What's sex? I said, well, honey, when you're old enough. She said, Daddy, I already know what communion is. Out of the mouths of babes. Communion? Communion. Mutuality. Tenderness, love. A give and take. A reciprocity. And here's the part where I have to say, and I have failed miserably about at that many times in the 39 years of marriage. That's why it's based on a covenant where my wife says to me on occasion, well, when I see you, I don't see you as the jerk that you are. I see you through the eyes of Jesus Christ. And when I wake up in the morning, I don't see her in a bad hair day. I see her as a woman who's got gifts, who's been called by God to steward those gifts. That through my wife, dozens of people have come to know Jesus Christ, and I support her. That through me, dozens, hundreds of people have come to know Jesus Christ, and my wife supports me. I could not do ministry. Greg would say the same thing. Gary would say the same thing. PJ would say the same thing. But it's not just for pastors. It's for you too. How are you using the gift of your singleness to draw people to Christ? How are you using the gift of your marriage to draw people to Christ? How are you using the gift of your life to draw people to Christ? That's Paul's operating principle. Let me go to Ephesians. Ephesians 5, 21 to 33. Many of you have been to weddings where you've heard this preached on. And they usually start here. Wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord. If you start there, you get the whole clause wrong. You need to start not at chapter 20, or not at verse 22, but at verse 21. Here's what verse 21 says. Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. That means that I have to submit to my wife sometimes. But I do. I do. And I don't always get it right. And sometimes I'm a jerk. But Jesus calls me to something different than all the messages I get from out there. Here's how it reads. If you say, submit yourselves to one another out of reverence for Christ. Wives, here's how you should submit. Submit yourselves to your own husbands as you do to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, and the Greek word for head is source. It's entirely different than the boss of you. It's the source. A husband has a relationship with the Lord that he ought to be a source for spiritual truth and grace and mercy. And in Paul's culture, when he says to a husband, and you should submit, all the men are going, you are crazy. Let me keep going. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives. As Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself. That's radical stuff. He says to the wives, you submit. To the husbands, he says, you serve like Christ did. What did Christ do? He died. I'm going to say this same thing in about 24 hours, right here to 50 guys. So this is nothing that I'm not going to share to everybody else. It's what I see when I look in the mirror and I fail miserably at this. Which is why I go back to the cross and say, Lord God, this week, one more time, forgive me for my jerkiness. That's what Paul's asking here. Because then what happens? Then people look in and say, how did you guys do that for 39 years? And I don't say, well, it's because of my exceptional husbanding skills. I say it's because of the grace of God mediated to me through that woman who's my wife. Just a little side note, when I was young, many of you have heard my story, drugs, blah, 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 all that stuff. It was the woman that I ended up marrying who prayed me out of that hell hole. I would not be here before you if it was not for my wife. So I get it most of the time. just finish with this. Here's what it says in the last book of the Bible. Here's why this is so important. Paul uses marriage and says, do you want to know what the relationship between Jesus and the church is? Well, marriages ought to be a picture of that. And if you're single, then you're married to Christ. If you're a husband and wife, then you're married to Christ and you're married to each other, and your relationship should reflect Jesus' relationship with the church. Here's what Revelation says. This is what will happen at the end. Let us be glad and rejoice. Let us give honor to him, for the time has come for the wedding feast of the Lamb. That one day the church will be adorned like a bride in white. Because we're pure? No. Because Jesus has made us pure in the cross. And his bride has prepared herself. She's been given the finest of pure white linen to wear, for the fine linen represents the good deeds of God's holy people. And the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. And he added, these are true words that come from God. What does love require us to do? So where are you in your relational life? Are you single? Great, pray. Lord God, what are you calling me to be? If you're calling me to be married, then help me to find the right person who together we can both honor you. If you're calling me to be single, then give me that gift because it's hard. If I'm in a marriage and my husband doesn't quite get the message of the cross yet, how can I pray and pray and pray and pray? And how can the church help me reach my husband? And if you're in a marriage that is doing well, or you haven't thought about this in a while, how can my husband and I shine the light of Christ into the dark world of our neighborhood, our cul-de-sac, our Bible study, our book club, our whatever it is, because that's what God has asked us to do. We're not wanting to leave you alone in this. We have a ministry called Marriage Ministry. Do we have somebody who wants to talk about that? Where is she? Janet!